He even agreed, after three strident requests from Adams, that the new ship might go directly to Boston, rather than accommodating the French minister by going to Philadelphia first. But it was to no avail. New specters of distrust had infected Adams's mind, and they were destined to haunt his relationship with Franklin when he returned the following year. While Adams simmered, Arthur Lee and his brothers declared open war on Franklin back in America. Lee circulated a letter accusing Franklin of weaving little plots and sowing pernicious dissension, and he also made sure that the Congress saw the flurry of accusatory letters to Franklin, questioning his honor, that he and Ralph Izzard had written earlier that year. Warned by his son-in-law, Richard Bache, of all these intrigues, Franklin was able to dismiss the resentments of the Lees. "My too great reputation," he wrote, "grieve those unhappy gentlemen, unhappy in their tempers and in the dark, uncomfortable passions of jealousy, anger, suspicion, envy, and malice." He was, however, far more wounded by Bache's reports that Lee and his allies were attacking Temple, for he loved his grandson with a blindness that was unusual for him. "Izzard, Lees and Company," Bache wrote, "lay some stress upon your employing as a private secretary your grandson, whom they hold unfit to be trusted because of his father's principles." Then he added ominously, "They have had some thoughts of bringing a motion to have him removed." In a separate note, Sally Bache confided that her husband had been afraid to inform Franklin of this campaign against Temple because he knew it would upset him. It certainly did. "Methinks it is rather some merit that I have rescued a valuable young man from the danger of being a Tory," he wrote Richard. Then he let loose a cry of anger at the thought that Temple might be recalled. "It is enough that I have lost my son. Would they add my grandson? An old man of 70, I undertook a winter voyage at the command of the Congress and for the public service, with no other attendant to take care of me. I am continued here in a foreign country, where, if I am sick, his filial attention comforts me. And if I die, I have a child to close my eyes and take care of my remains." In a letter to Sally at the same time, he repeated these sentiments and added that trying to deprive him of Temple would be cruel but futile. "I should not part with the child, but with the employment," he threatened. "But I am confident that whatever may be proposed by weak or malicious people, the Congress is too wise and too good to think of treating me in that manner." The Congress was, indeed, supportive. There was no serious effort to have Temple dismissed, and he remained the secretary to the American delegation. Temple was about 19 at the time, still a roguish lad who worked hard but had earned the deep respect of few besides his grandfather. As the controversy swirled around him in the summer of 1779, he decided to prove his mettle by taking part in an audacious mission with Lafayette to launch a surprise attack on Britain itself. The French general, less than 3 years older than Temple, had recently returned from serving under George Washington. By this time, the Revolution had reached an unsteady stalemate, with British troops under Sir Henry Clinton still ensconced in New York, but doing little for the time being other than conducting hit-and-run raids. So Lafayette, on arriving back in Paris, hatched his audacious plan to attack the British mainland, and he shared it with Franklin and the French military. "I admire much the activity of your genius," Franklin wrote. "It is certain that the coasts of England and Scotland are extremely open and defenseless." he conceded that he did not know enough about military strategy to presume upon advising it. But he could give encouragement. Many instances of history prove that in war, attempts thought to be impossible do often for that very reason become possible and practicable, because nobody expects them. Lafayette was eager to have Temple at his side. "We will be always together during the campaign, which I do assure you gives me great pleasure," he wrote the young man. For his part, Temple, ever the dandy, fretted about his rank, his title, his commission, and his uniform. He wanted to be commissioned as an officer rather than merely as a volunteer, and he insisted on the right to wear the epaulettes of an officer, even though Lafayette advised against it. Just as all these issues were being settled, the land invasion was called off by the French military. Franklin professed to be disappointed. "I flattered myself," he wrote Lafayette, "that he might possibly catch from you some tincture of those engaging manners that make you so much the delight of all that know you." Once again, Temple's chance to make a name for himself on his own was scuttled. John Paul Jones. One component of the proposed invasion of Britain did proceed, and it inserted a colorful character into Franklin's life. When Lafayette was first planning his mission, Franklin told him that "much will depend on a prudent and brave sea commander who knows the coasts." They settled instead for a commander who was, as Franklin was already well aware, more brave than prudent, John Paul Jones. Born John Paul, the son of a Scottish landscape designer, he had shipped off to sea at age 13, served as the first mate of a slave vessel, and soon commanded his own merchant ship. But the hot-headed captain, who throughout his career was prone to provoking mutinies, got into trouble by flogging a crew member who later died, and then, after being exonerated, running his sword through yet another crew member who was threatening an insurrection. So he fled to Virginia, changed his last name to Jones, and at the beginning of the Revolution won a commission in America's motley navy of ex-privateers and adventurers. By 1778 he was making his reputation by conducting daring attacks along the English and Scottish coasts. On one of these raids, Jones decided to kidnap a Scottish earl. But the man was away, taking the waters down in Bath, so the crew instead forced his wife to hand over the family silver. In a fit of noble guilt, Jones decided to buy the booty from his crew so that he could return it to the family, and he wrote a flowery letter to the earl declaring his intention, copies of which he circulated to various friends, including Franklin, who had by then assumed the difficult task of acting as his American overseer, as well as his occasional host in Passy. Franklin tried to help Jones resolve the problem, but it led to such a convoluted exchange of letters with the outraged earl and his baffled wife that the silver was not returned until after the end of the war. Franklin decided that the impetuous captain would do more good, or less harm, if he focused his raids on the Channel Islands instead. "The Jersey privateers do us a great deal of mischief," he wrote to Jones in May 1778. "It has been mentioned to me that your small vessel, commanded by so brave an officer, might render great service by following them where greater ships dare not venture." He added that the suggestion came from high authority, meaning the great French naval minister Antoine Sartine. Jones, not so easily managed, replied that his ship, Ranger, was too crank and slow, and it would require promises of great reward for him to convince his men to undertake more missions. But he knew how to flatter Franklin. He sent him a copy of his battle journals, which Franklin read avidly. So, without permission from his fellow commissioners or from France, Franklin decided that Jones should be given command of a ship that had just been built for the Americans in Amsterdam. Alas, the nervous Dutch, who were trying to remain neutral, scuttled the plan, especially after the British, who had learned of it through their spy Bancroft, applied pressure. Franklin was finally able to help secure for Jones in February 1779 an old 40-gun man-of-war named the Duras, which Jones promptly rechristened the Bonhomme Richard in his patron's honor. Jones was so thrilled that he paid a visit to Passy that month to thank Franklin and his landlord Chamon, who had helped supply Jones with uniforms and funds. There was perhaps another reason for the visit. Jones may have been having an illicit affair with Madame de Chamon. During this stay, an incident occurred that, as played out in subsequent letters, resembled a French farce. A weazened old woman, who was the wife of the Chameau's gardener, alleged that Jones tried to rape her. Franklin made a passing allusion to the alleged incident in a postscript to a subsequent letter, and Jones mistakenly assumed that the mystery you so delicately mention referred to the controversy that surrounded his killing of the rebellious crew member years earlier. So he provided a long and anguished account of that old travail. Confused and somewhat amused by Jones's detailed explanation of impaling the mutineer, Franklin replied that he had never heard that story, and informed Jones that the mystery he alluded to referred instead to an allegation made by the gardener's wife that Jones had attempted to ravish her in the bushes of the estate at about 7 o'clock the evening before your departure. The woman had recounted the horror in great detail, some of which are not fit for me to write, and three of her sons had declared that they were determined to kill you. But Jones should not worry. Everyone at Passy found the tale to be the subject of great merriment. It occasioned some laughing, wrote Franklin, the old woman being one of the grossest, coarsest, dirtiest, and ugliest that one may find in 1,000. Madame Chamon, whose own familiarity with Jones's sexual appetites did not prevent her from a great display of French insouciance, declared that it gave a high idea of the strength of appetite and courage of the Americans. They all ended up concluding, Franklin assured Jones, that it must have been a case of mistaken identity. As part of the Mardi Gras festivities, a chamber girl had apparently dressed up in one of his uniforms, and, so they surmised, attacked the gardener's wife as a prank. It seems quite implausible that the gardener's wife, even in the dimness of early evening, could have been so easily fooled. Not even their friend Beaumarchais would have attempted such a cross-dressing rape scene in The Marriage of Figaro. But the explanation was satisfactory enough that the event was not mentioned in subsequent letters. All of this occurred just as Franklin was helping to plan the proposed sneak attack on Britain by Jones and Lafayette, who had both arrived at Passy and were spending hours warily assessing one another under Franklin's worried eye. Both officers were proud, and they were soon struggling over matters large and small, ranging from who would be in charge of various aspects of the invasion to whether their men would eat at the same tables. Franklin resorted to his most indirect manner in trying to soothe Jones. It has been observed that joint expeditions of land and sea forces often miscarry through jealousies and misunderstandings between the officers of different corps, he pointed out. Then, saying almost the opposite of what he truly felt, he added, "Knowing you both as I do, and your just manner of thinking on these occasions, I am confident nothing of the kind can happen between you." But Franklin made it clear that he was concerned, quite understandably, about Jones's temperament. A cool, prudent conduct was necessary, he cautioned. Jones must remember that Lafayette was the ranking officer, and it would be a kind of trial of your abilities and of your fitness in temper and disposition for acting in concert with others. In his formal set of instructions to Jones, Franklin was even more explicit in ordering him to show restraint, especially in light of his crew's previous plundering of the Scottish Earl's silver. "Although the English have wantonly burnt many defenseless towns in America, you are not to follow this example, unless where a reasonable ransom is refused, in which case your own generous feelings, as well as this instruction, will induce you to give timely notice of your intention, so that sick and ancient persons, women and children, may be first removed." Replied Jones, "Your liberal and noble-minded instructions would make a coward brave." When Lafayette's part of the mission was scrapped, Franklin and the French decided that Jones should proceed with a purely naval attack, which he did in September 1779. The result was the fabled sea battle between the Bonhomme Richard and the much better-equipped Serapis. When the British captain, after applying a fierce pounding, asked him to surrender, Jones replied, at least according to legend, "I have not yet begun to fight." As Jones put it in his vivid and detailed account of the battle to Franklin, "I answered him in the most determined negative." Jones was able to lash the Bonhomme Richard into a death grip with the Serapis, and his men scrambled up the masts to lob grenades into the ammunition holds of the enemy ship. After a three-hour battle, in which half of his 300 crew members were killed or wounded, Jones captured control of the Serapis just before the Bonhomme Richard sank. "The scene was dreadful beyond the reach of language," he wrote Franklin. "Humanity cannot but recoil and lament that war should be capable of producing such fatal consequences." Franklin took great pride in Jones's success, and they became even closer friends. "Scarce anything was talked of at Paris and Versailles but your cool conduct and persevering bravery during that terrible conflict," he replied. He helped to get Jones, who was desperately eager to gain social respect, initiated into the Nine Sisters Masonic Lodge, and he accompanied him on a triumphal visit to the king at Versailles. Franklin even got embroiled in Jones's lengthy and bitter disputes with the insubordinate Pierre Landais, captain of the Alliance, which was supposed to be part of Jones's fleet. Landais had failed to come to the rescue during the battle with the Serapis, and in fact had actually fired on the Bonhomme Richard. For the next 2 years, Franklin and Jones fought with Landais, who was supported by Arthur Lee, over who should be the captain of the Alliance. When Landais finally commandeered the vessel and sailed away, a beleaguered Franklin decided it was best to let others sort it all out. He had other things in France to deal with. Friend of the Court. The absence of John Adams from Paris, so pleasing both to Franklin and the French court, was too good to last. He had left in a mood even more sour than usual after Franklin was made the sole minister to France, but he had been home only a few months when the Congress decided to send him back to Paris. His new official mission was to negotiate a peace accord with the British, if and when the time ever became ripe. As the time was not, in fact, ripe for such talks, Adams contented himself by meddling in Franklin's duties. This thoroughly annoyed the French Foreign Minister Vergennes. When Adams proposed, on his arrival in February 1780, to make public his authority to negotiate with the British, Vergennes invoked the American promise not to act independently of France. He should say and do nothing. "Above all," Vergennes sternly instructed him, "take the necessary precautions that the object of your commission remain unknown to the Court of London." Franklin was also annoyed. Adams's return threatened to disrupt his careful cultivation of the French court, and it reminded him of the attacks on his reputation that had long been waged by the Adams and Lee family factions in the Congress. In a ruminative mood, he wrote Washington a letter that ostensibly offered reassurance about the general's reputation, but clearly reflected his worries about his own. "I must soon quit the scene," Franklin wrote, in an unusually introspective way, referring not to his post in France, but his life in this world. "Washington's own great reputation in France," he said, "was free from those little shades that the jealousy and envy of a man's countrymen and contemporaries are ever endeavoring to cast over living merit." It was clear that he was trying to reassure not only Washington, but also himself, that history would ignore the feeble voice of those groveling passions. More specifically, Franklin sought to explain to himself and his friends, and also to history, why Adams, rather than he, had been chosen to negotiate any potential peace with Britain. Just as Adams was arriving, Franklin wrote a letter to his old friend David Hartley, a member of Parliament with whom he had previously discussed prisoner exchanges and peace feelers. Hartley had proposed a 10-year truce between Britain and America. Franklin replied that it was his private opinion that a truce might make sense, but he noted that "neither you nor I are at present authorized to negotiate such matters." That authority now resided with Adams, and Franklin put his own spin on the Congress's choice. "If the Congress have therefore entrusted to others rather than to me the negotiations for peace, when such shall be set on foot, as has been reported, it is perhaps because they may have heard of a very singular opinion of mine, that there hardly ever existed such a thing as a bad peace or a good war, and that I might therefore easily be induced to make improper concessions." Franklin had indeed often used the phrase about there being no such thing as a bad peace or a good war, and he would repeat it to dozens of other friends after the Revolution ended. It is sometimes used as an anti-war slogan, and cited to cast Franklin as one of history's noble pacifists. But that is misleading. Throughout his life, Franklin supported wars when he felt they were warranted. He had helped form militias in Philadelphia and raised supplies for the battles with the French and Indians. Though he had initially worked to avert the Revolution, he supported it strongly when he decided that independence was inevitable. The sentiments in his letter were aimed both at Hartley and at history. He wanted to explain why he had not been chosen as a peace negotiator. Perhaps more intriguing, he also wanted to let his friends in Britain know that he could eventually provide a good channel, better than Adams, if the talks ever began. In the meantime, Franklin was ardently committed to the French alliance, more so than most of his American colleagues. This led to a great public rift with Adams after his return in early 1780. Previously, the tension between the two men had been based more on their differences in personality and style, but this one was caused by a fundamental disagreement over policy, whether or not America should show gratitude, allegiance, and fealty to France. In the early days of the Revolution, both men shared a somewhat isolationist or exceptionalist view, one that has since been a thread throughout American history. The United States should never be a supplicant in seeking support from other nations, and it should be coy and cautious about entering into entangling foreign alliances. Even after he began his love affair with France in 1777, Franklin restated this principle. "I have never yet changed the opinion I gave in Congress that a virgin state should preserve the virgin character and not go about suitoring for alliances," he assured Arthur Lee. In negotiating the alliance with France, he had successfully resisted making any concessions that would give a monopoly over American trade or favors. Once the treaties were signed in early 1778, however, Franklin became a strong believer in showing gratitude and loyalty. In the words of diplomatic historian Gerald Stourge, he extolled the magnanimity and generosity of France in terms which at times touch on the slightly ridiculous. America's fealty to France, in Franklin's view, was based on idealism as well as realism, and he described it in moral terms rather than merely in the cold calculus of commercial advantages and European power balances. "This is really a generous nation, fond of glory, and particularly that of protecting the oppressed," he declared of France in a letter to the Congress. "Telling them their commerce will be advantaged by our success, and that it is their interest to help us, seems as much to say, 'Help us, and we shall not be obliged to you.' Such indiscreet and improper language has been sometimes held here by some of our people and produced no good effects." Adams, on the other hand, was much more of a cold realist. He felt that France had supported America because of its own national interests, weakening Britain, gaining a lucrative new trading relationship, and neither side owed the other any moral gratitude. France, he correctly predicted, would help America only up to a point. It wanted the new nation to break with Britain, but not to become so strong that it no longer needed France's support. Franklin showed too much subservience to the court, Adams felt. And on his return in 1780, he forcefully propounded this view. "We ought to be cautious," Adams wrote the Congress in April, "how we magnify our ideas and exaggerate our expressions of the generosity and magnanimity of any of those powers." Vergennes, not surprisingly, was eager to deal only with Franklin. And by the end of July 1780, he had exchanged enough strained correspondence with Adams, on everything from American currency revaluation to the deployment of the French Navy, that he felt justified in sending him a stinging letter that managed to be both formally diplomatic and undiplomatic at the same time. On behalf of the court of Louis XVI, he declared, "The king did not stand in need of your solicitations to direct his attentions to the interests of the United States." In other words, France would not deal with Adams any longer. Vergennes informed Franklin of this decision and sent him copies of all his testy correspondence with Adams, with the request that Franklin lay the whole before Congress. In his reply, Franklin was exceedingly candid with Vergennes, indeed dangerously so, in revealing his own frustration with Adams. "It was from his particular indiscretion alone, and not from any instructions received by him, that he has given such just cause of displeasure." Franklin went on to explicitly distance himself from Adams's activities. "He has never yet communicated to me more of his business in Europe than I have seen in the newspapers," Franklin told Vergennes. "I live upon terms of civility with him, not of intimacy." He concluded by promising to send the Congress the offending Adams correspondence that Vergennes had supplied. Although Franklin could have, and perhaps should have, dispatched the letters without comment, he took the opportunity to write, with reluctance, a letter of his own to the Congress that detailed his disagreement with Adams. Their dispute was partly due to a difference in style. Adams believed in blunt assertions of American interests, whereas Franklin favored suasion and diplomatic charm. But the dispute was also caused by a fundamental difference in philosophy. Adams believed that America's foreign policy should be based on realism. Franklin believed that it should also include an element of idealism, both as a moral duty and as a component of America's national interests. As Franklin put it in his letter, "Mr. Adams thinks, as he tells me himself, that America has been too free in expressions of gratitude to France. For that she is more obliged to us than we to her, and that we should show spirit in our applications. I apprehend that he mistakes his ground, and that this court is to be treated with decency and delicacy. The king, a young and virtuous prince, has, I am persuaded, a pleasure in reflecting on the generous benevolence of the action in assisting an oppressed people, and proposes it as a part of the glory of his reign. I think it right to increase this pleasure by our thankful acknowledgments, and that such an expression of gratitude is not only our duty, but our interest." With the British not yet ready to deal with him, and the French no longer willing to deal with him, Adams once again left Paris feeling resentful. And Franklin once again tried to keep their disagreements from becoming personal. He wrote to Adams in Holland, where he had gone to try to elicit a loan for America, and commiserated about the difficulties of that task. "I have long been humiliated," he said, "with the idea of our running from court to court begging for money and friendship." And in a subsequent letter complaining about how long France was taking to answer his own requests, Franklin wryly wrote Adams, "I have, however, two of the Christian graces, faith and hope. But my faith is only that of which the Apostle speaks, the evidence of things not seen. If their mutual endeavors failed," he added, "I shall be ready to break, run away, or go to prison with you, as it shall please God." America's need for more money had indeed become quite desperate by the end of 1780. Earlier in the year, the British commander, Sir Henry Clinton, had sailed south from New York, with General Cornwallis as his deputy, to launch an attack on Charleston, South Carolina. It succeeded in May, and Cornwallis set up a British command there after Clinton returned to New York. Also that summer, the troubled American general Benedict Arnold had turned coat in a way that made his name synonymous with treachery. "Our present situation," Washington wrote Franklin in October of that year, "makes one of two things essential to us: a peace, or the most vigorous aid of our allies, particularly in the article of money." Franklin thus resorted to all of his wiles, personal pleadings mixed with appeals to idealism and national interests, in his application to Vergennes in February 1781. "I am grown old," he said, adding that his illness made it probable that he would soon retire. "The present conjuncture is critical." If more money did not come soon, the Congress could lose its influence, the new government would be stillborn, and England would recover control over America. That, he warned, would tilt the balance of power in a way that will enable them to become the terror of Europe and to exercise with impunity that insolence which is so natural to their nation. His request was audacious. 25 million livres, the rough equivalent of $130 million in purchasing power in 2002 U.S. dollars. In the end, France agreed to provide 6 million, which was a great victory for Franklin and enough money to keep American hopes alive. Franklin, however, was disheartened. Back home, his enemies were being as vindictive as ever. "The political salvation of America depends upon the recalling of Dr. Franklin," Ralph Izzard wrote Richard Lee. Even Vergennes expressed some doubts that made their way back to the Congress. "Although I have a high esteem for Monsieur Franklin," he wrote to his minister in Philadelphia, "I am nevertheless obliged to concede that his age and his love of tranquillity produce an apathy incompatible with the affairs in his charge." Izzard pushed a recall vote that was supported by the Lee-Adams faction. Although Franklin easily survived, the Congress did decide to send a special envoy to take over the work of handling future financial transactions. So, in March, after receiving word of France's new loan, Franklin informed the Congress that he was ready to resign. "I have passed my 75th year," he wrote, adding that he was plagued by gout and weakness. "I do not know that my mental faculties are impaired. Perhaps I shall be the last to discover that." Having served in public life for 50 years, he had received honor sufficient to satisfy any reasonable ambition, and I have no other left but that of repose, which I hope Congress will grant me. He included one personal request, that the members find a job for his grandson Temple, who had passed up the chance to study law so that he could serve his country in Paris. "If they shall think fit to employ him as a secretary to their minister at any European court, I am persuaded they will have reason to be satisfied with his conduct, and I shall be thankful for his appointment as a favor to me." Peace Commissioner. The Congress refused Franklin's offer to resign. Instead, in what came as a pleasant surprise, he was not only kept on as minister to France, he was also given an additional role, one of the 5 commissioners to handle the peace negotiations with Britain if and when the time came for an end to the war. The others were John Adams, who originally had been designated the sole negotiator and was at the time still in Holland, Thomas Jefferson, who again declined the overseas assignment for personal reasons, South Carolina planter merchant Henry Lawrence, who was captured at sea by the British and imprisoned in the Tower of London, and New York lawyer John Jay. Franklin's selection was controversial, and it came partly because of pressure from Vergennes. Despite his doubts about Franklin's energy, the French minister instructed his envoy in Philadelphia to lobby on his behalf and inform the Congress that his conduct is as zealous and patriotic as it is wise and circumspect. Vergennes also asked the Congress to require that the new delegation take no steps without France's approval. The Congress complied by giving its commissioners strict instructions to make the most candid and confidential communications upon all subjects to the ministers of our generous ally, the King of France, to undertake nothing in the negotiations for peace or truce without their knowledge and concurrence. Adams was appalled at being so shackled to France's will, and he called the instructions shameful. Jay agreed, declaring that by casting herself into the arms of the King of France, America would not advance either her interest or her reputation. Franklin, on the other hand, was pleased with the instructions to follow France's guidance. "I have had so much experience of His Majesty's goodness to us," he wrote the Congress, "and of the sincerity of this upright and able minister, Vergennes, that I cannot but think the confidence well and judiciously placed, and that it will have happy effects." He was heartened as well by a personal triumph. Over the objections of even such friends as Silas Deane, he was able to get Temple appointed as the secretary to the new delegation. The honor of his new appointment and the rejection of his resignation rejuvenated him. "I call this continuance an honor," he wrote a friend, "and I really esteem it to be greater than my first appointment, when I consider that all the interest of my enemies were not sufficient to prevent it." He even wrote another friendly letter to Adams, whose own commission to negotiate with Britain had been diluted by the addition of the new delegation. Their mutual appointments, Franklin told Adams, were a great honor, but he wryly lamented that they were likely to be criticized for whatever they accomplished. "I have never known a peace made, even the most advantageous, that was not censured as inadequate," he said. "Blessed are the peacemakers" is, I suppose, to be understood in the other world, for in this they are frequently cursed. As a master of the relationship between power and diplomacy, Franklin knew that it would be impossible to win at the negotiating table what was unwinnable on the battlefield. He had been able to negotiate an alliance with France only after America had won the Battle of Saratoga in 1777. He would be able to negotiate a suitable peace with Britain only after America and its French allies won an even more decisive victory. That problem was solved in October 1781. The British general Lord Cornwallis had marched north from Charleston, seeking to engage General Washington's forces, and had taken his stand at Yorktown, Virginia. France's support proved critical. Lafayette moved to Cornwallis's southern flank to prevent a retreat. A French fleet arrived at the mouth of the Chesapeake to preclude an escape by sea. French artillery arrived from Rhode Island, and 9,000 French soldiers joined 11,000 Americans under General Washington's command. Two 400-man columns, one French and the other American, began the Allied assault and bombardment, which continued day and night with such intensity that when Cornwallis sent out a drummer on October 17th to signal his willingness to surrender, it took a while for him to get noticed. It had been 4 years since the Battle of Saratoga, 6.5 since Lexington and Concord. On November 19th, word of the Allied triumph at Yorktown reached Vergennes, who sent a note to Franklin that he reprinted on his press at Passy and distributed the following dawn. Although the war seemed effectively over, Franklin was cautious. Until the present ministry resigned, there was always the chance that Britain would renew the struggle. "I remember that when I was a boxing boy, it was allowed, even after an adversary said he had enough to give him a rising blow, he wrote Robert Morris, the American finance minister. Let ours be a douser. Lord North's government finally collapsed in March 1782, replaced by one headed by Lord Rockingham. Peace talks between America and Britain could now begin. Franklin, it so happened, was the only one of the five American commissioners who was then in Paris. So for the next few months, until Jay and then Adams finally arrived, he would handle the negotiations on his own. In doing so, he would face two complicating factors. America had pledged to coordinate its diplomacy with France and her allies rather than negotiate with London separately. But the British wanted direct talks leading to a separate peace with America. Franklin, on the surface, would initially insist on acting in concert with the French, but behind the scenes he would arrange for private and direct peace negotiations with the British. The Rockingham government had two rival ministers, Foreign Secretary Charles Fox and Colonial Secretary Lord Shelburne, each of whom sent their own negotiators to Paris. Franklin would maneuver to ensure that Shelburne's envoy, whom he liked better and found more malleable, was given a commission to negotiate with the Americans. The negotiations begin. Great affairs sometimes take their rise from small circumstances, Franklin recorded in the journal he began of the 1782 peace negotiations. In this case, it was a chance meeting between his old flame, Madame Brion, and an Englishman named Lord Cholmondeley, who was a friend of Shelburne. Madame Brion sent Cholmondeley to call on Franklin in Passy, and through him Franklin sent his regards to the new colonial secretary. Franklin had known and liked Shelburne since at least 1766, when he lobbied him about getting a western land grant and made occasional visits to his grand country manor in Wiltshire. Madame Helvétius also played a small role. Shelburne had just sent her some gooseberry bushes, and Franklin wrote politely that they had arrived in excellent order. Shelburne responded by dispatching Richard Oswald, a retired one-eyed London merchant and former slave trader who had once lived in America, to begin negotiating with Franklin. Oswald arrived on April 15th. And immediately tried to convince Franklin that America could get a quicker and better deal if it negotiated independently of the French. Franklin was not yet willing. "I let him know," he wrote, "that America would not treat but in concert with France." Instead, he took Oswald to Versailles the next day to meet with Vergennes, who proposed to host a general peace conference of all the warring parties in Paris. On the way back from Versailles, Oswald argued again for a separate peace. Once the issue of American independence was settled by negotiations, he said, it should not be held up while matters relating only to France and Spain, including the ownership of Gibraltar, were still being disputed. He added an implicit threat. If France became involved and made too many demands, England would continue the war and finance it by stopping payment on its public debt. The issue of independence, Franklin pointedly replied, had already been settled back in 1776. Britain should simply acknowledge it, rather than offer to negotiate it. As for reneging on their debt in order to renew the war, Franklin made no reply. "I did not desire to discourage their stopping payment, which I considered as cutting the throat of their public credit," he wrote in his journal. Such menaces were besides an encouragement with me, remembering the old adage that they who threaten are afraid. Instead, Franklin suggested that Britain consider offering reparations to America, especially to those who had suffered by the scalping and burning parties that England had enlisted the Indians to wage. Nothing could have a greater tendency to conciliate, he said, and that would lead to the renewal of commerce that Britain both needed and desired. He even suggested a specific reparations proposal. Britain should offer to cede control of Canada. The money Britain could make from the Canadian fur trade, after all, was tiny compared to what it would save by not having to defend Canada. It was also far less than Britain could make through the renewed commerce with America that would flow from a friendly settlement. In addition, the money that America made from selling open land in Canada could be used to compensate the patriots whose homes had been destroyed by British troops, and also the British loyalists whose estates had been confiscated by the Americans. Behind France's back, Franklin was playing a wily balance-of-power game. He knew that France, despite her enmity toward Britain, did not want it to cede control of Canada to America. That would make America's borders more secure, reduce its tensions with Britain, and lessen its need for a friendship with France. If England continued to hold Canada, Franklin explained to Oswald, it would necessarily oblige us to cultivate and strengthen our union with France. In his report to Vergennes about his conversation with Oswald, Franklin did not mention that he had suggested the ceding of Canada. It was the first small indication that Franklin, despite his insistence that he would work hand in glove with the French, would be willing to act unilaterally when warranted. As usual, Franklin was speaking from notes he had prepared, and Oswald begged to be trusted with them so he could show them to Shelburne. After some hesitation, Franklin agreed. Oswald was charmed by Franklin's trust, and Franklin found Oswald to be sensible and devoid of guile. "We parted exceeding good friends," he noted. Franklin had one regret about the paper he entrusted to Oswald. Its hint that compensation might be due to the British loyalists in America whose property had been confiscated. So he published on his Passy Press and sent to Adams and others a fake issue of a Boston newspaper that purported to describe in gruesome detail the horrors that the British had perpetrated on innocent Americans. His goal was to emphasize that no sympathy was due the British loyalists, and that it was the Americans who deserved compensation. The fake edition was cleverly convincing. It featured a description of a shipment of American scalps purportedly sent by the Seneca Indians to England, and a letter that he pretended was from John Paul Jones. To make it more realistic, he even included fake little ads about a new brick house for sale in South Boston and a missing bay mare in Salem. Britain agreed to Vergennes' proposal for an all-parties peace conference, but that meant sending a new envoy, one who represented the Foreign Secretary Charles Fox rather than the Colonial Secretary Shelburne. The new envoy's name was not auspicious. Thomas Grenville, the son of the despised George Grenville, who had imposed the Stamp Act back in 1765. But Fox, who had long been sympathetic to the American side, assured Franklin that the young Grenville, a mere 27, was to be trusted. I know your liberality of mind too well to be afraid that any prejudices against Mr. Granville's name may prevent you from esteeming those excellent qualities of heart and head which belong to him, or from giving the fullest credit to the sincerity of his wishes for peace. When Granville arrived in early May, Franklin immediately took him to Versailles, where the young Englishman made the mistake of suggesting to Vergennes that if England gave America independence, France should give back some of the Caribbean islands it had conquered, and a peace could be quickly settled. With the hint of a smile, Vergennes turned on the novice English diplomat and belittled his offer of independence. "America," he said, "did not ask it of you. There is Mr. Franklin. He will answer you as to that point." "To be sure," said Franklin, "we do not consider ourselves as under any necessity of bargaining for such a thing that is our own, and which we have bought at the expense of much blood and treasure." Like Oswald, Grenville hoped to be able to convince Franklin to negotiate a separate peace with Britain, rather than remain linked to France's demands as well. To that end, he visited Passy a few days later and warned that France might insist on provisions that were not related to the treaty she had made with America. If that happened, America should not feel obligated by that treaty to continue the war to obtain such points for her. As he had done with Oswald, Franklin refused to make such a concession. "I gave a little more of my sentiments on the general subject of benefits, obligations, and gratitude," Franklin noted. "People who wanted to get out of obligations often became ingenious in finding out reasons and arguments to do so. But America would not follow that route. Even if a person borrows money from another and then repays it, he still owes gratitude. He has discharged the money debt, but the obligation remains." "This was stretching the idea of gratitude rather far," replied Grenville, "for France was the party that actually benefited from America's separation from Britain. Franklin insisted that he felt so strongly about the generous and noble manner in which France had supported America that I could never suffer myself to think of such reasonings for lessening the obligations." Grenville further annoyed Franklin by trying to hide the fact that his commission gave him the authority to negotiate only with France and not directly with the United States, which Britain did not yet recognize as an independent country. Franklin confronted him on this point at the beginning of June. Why did his commission not explicitly authorize him, Franklin asked, to deal directly with the United States? As Franklin reported to Adams the next day, "He could not explain this to my satisfaction, but said he believed the omission was occasioned by their copying an old commission." That, of course, did not convince Franklin. He insisted that Grenville get a new commission before any negotiations could begin. This was not merely a nicety of protocol, as Franklin well knew. He was insisting that the British tacitly accept America's independence as a precondition for talks. "I imagine there is a reluctance in their king to take this first step," he wrote Adams, "as the giving such a commission would itself be a kind of acknowledgment of our independence." Franklin was willing to work in concert with France, but he had no intention of allowing Britain to insist that France negotiate on America's behalf. Vergennes agreed. "They want to treat with us for you, but this the king will not agree to. He thinks it not consistent with the dignity of your state. You will treat for yourselves." All that was necessary, Vergennes added, was that the treaties go hand in hand and are signed the same day. Wittingly or not, Vergennes had given Franklin tacit permission to begin separate discussions with the British. Because the British were very eager to have such talks, and because there were two British negotiators vying to conduct them, Franklin had a lot of leverage. When Grenville returned to Passy at the beginning of June to argue once again for direct talks, this time Franklin decided to evade the discussion rather than reject the idea. If Spain and Holland, and even if France, should insist on unreasonable terms, Grenville asked, can it be right that America should be dragged on in a war for their interests only? It was unnecessary to enter at present into considerations of that kind, Franklin replied. If any of the other powers should make extravagant demands, he continued enticingly, it would then be time enough to consider what our obligations were. Because Grenville was so eager to get direct talks underway, he was willing to tell Franklin confidentially that he was instructed to acknowledge the independence of America previous to the commencement of the treaty. Oswald was also eager for direct talks to begin, and he came to Passy 2 days later to hint that he would be willing to serve as Britain's negotiator if Franklin preferred. He was coy. He was not trying to supplant Grenville, he insisted, for he was old and had no need for further glory. But it was clear to Franklin that he was now in the happy position of having a choice between two hungry suitors. Oswald was more sophisticated than Grenville, and he was able to appear both more eager and more threatening. Peace was absolutely necessary for Britain, he confided. Our enemies may now do what they please with us. They have the ball at their foot. On the other hand, there were those back in London who were a little too much elated by Britain's recent victory over the French Navy in a major battle in the West Indies. If he and Franklin did not act soon, they might prevail in prolonging the war. There had even been serious discussions, Oswald warned, of ways to finance further fighting by cancelling debt payment only on bonds of more than £1,000, which would not upset most of the population. Franklin noted that he viewed this as a kind of intimidation. Yet Oswald was able to soften Franklin through flattery. He repeatedly mentioned the great esteem the ministers had for me, Franklin recorded. They depended on me for the means of extricating the nation from its present desperate situation, that perhaps no single man had ever in his hands an opportunity of doing so much good as I had at present. Oswald further endeared himself to Franklin by seeming to agree with him privately on what should be in a treaty. When Franklin railed against the idea of paying compensation to loyalists whose estates had been confiscated, saying that such a demand would elicit a contrary one from America demanding reparations for all the towns the British had burned, Oswald confidentially said that he personally felt the same. He also said that he agreed with Franklin that Britain should cede Canada to America. It was as if he were competing with young Grenville in an audition for the job of being Britain's negotiator and trying to win Franklin's recommendation. Indeed, oddly enough, he was. He showed Franklin a memo that Shelburne had written that offered to give Oswald, if Franklin wished it, a commission to be the special negotiator with America. Shelburne wrote that he was willing to give Oswald any authority, which Dr. Franklin and he may judge conducive to a final settlement of things between Great Britain and America. That way, Shelburne's memo added, Britain could forge a peace with America in a very different manner from the peace between Great Britain and France, who have always been at enmity with each other. Oswald coyly noted that Grenville was a very sensible young gentleman, and he was perfectly willing to leave it to him to conduct the negotiations in concert with France. However, if Franklin thought it would be useful to have Oswald deal directly with the Americans, he was content to give his time and service. Franklin was happy to accept. Oswald's knowledge of America, he noted, meant that he would be better than Grenville in persuading the ministry to things reasonable. Franklin asked Oswald whether he would prefer to negotiate with all the countries, including France, or to negotiate with America alone. Oswald's answer, obviously, was the latter. He said he did not choose to be concerned in treating with the foreign powers, Franklin noted. If he accepted any commission, it should be that of treating with America. Franklin agreed to write Shelburne secretly recommending that course. Partly, Franklin was motivated by his affection for Oswald, who was his age, and his lack of affection for the younger Grenville, who had annoyed Franklin by leaking to the London Evening Post an inaccurate account of one of their meetings. "Mr. Oswald, an old man, seems now to have no desire but that of being useful in doing good," Franklin noted. "Mr. Grenville, a young man, naturally desirous of acquiring a reputation, seems to aim at that of being an able negotiator." Franklin, though still ambitious at 76, now believed in the moderating effects of old age. Although Franklin had made a great show of insisting that the French be involved in all negotiations, he had come to believe that it was now in America's interest to have its own separate and private channel with Britain. So, when he went to Versailles in mid-June, a week after his momentous meeting with Oswald, he was less candid than usual with Vergennes. "We spoke of all Britain's attempts to separate us and the prudence of holding together and treating in concert," he recorded. This time, however, he held back some information.